Okay, hi everyone. Thank you for being here, and thank you to the organizers for giving me this opportunity to speak to you today. So in this talk, I'll be discussing ways in which we can measure ionization properties of protoplanetary disks. This is hard work to do, and so a lot of this will be theoretical ways in which we can measure the ionization properties of protoplanetary disks. But we do have a couple of measurements, and I have some new exciting work at the end. If I get to, I'm excited to share with you. So just to give a little background, and I always love going after Meredith because she gives such a fantastic overview of this phase. But in this talk, I'm really focusing here on the protoplanetary disk phase. This is the phase when the accretion rate has substantially dropped through the disk. And so the star is mostly, it's built up most of its mass. It's not really gaining much mass from the disk. And the disk's main job is to go about forming planets or planetesimals. Excuse me. And so it's got a few million years to do this. And so we want to understand this disk's properties. We want to understand how and where and when it's turbulent. We want to understand also how and when and where it is ionized. The reason we care so much about ionization is manifold, actually. So it regulates the active chemistry in most of the molecular gas. So most of the disk is below 100 Kelvin, mostly below 50 Kelvin. And so at these temperatures, the reactions that really dominate the forward motion to complexity are ion-neutral reactions. So you need ions for those. The same is true, actually, for the formation of ices like water, methanol, important prebiotic ices. But also, you know, most importantly, for the reasons that we're here, is that the ionization state of the disk tells us how well it couples to the magnetic fields that perhaps are threading it. And so when I discuss ionization today, I'll be talking about ionization of the bulk gas, of molecular hydrogen, of helium. And to ionize these species, you need more than 36 eV. So this is really X-rays and cosmic rays and radioactivity. This is not really UV here. And I hope to also impress upon you that there are large gradients in the overall ionization structure in the disk, and there are many different sources impinging on the disk, some of which are shown here. So you have this sort of is structured from external to internal forces, where you can have nearby massive stars irradiating the disk from the outside. You can also have galactic cosmic rays bombard the disk from the outside in. And so these pervade the galaxy, but you can also have an excess of cosmic rays nearby if you have massive stars that are going through their later phase of life and going through supernovae. You can also have colliding wind binaries, all these local sources of cosmic rays enhancing the local flux. Also, these stars, when these massive stars die, they can substantially pollute the gas in which future stars and planets are forming from. And so these are in the form of 26 aluminum iron 60 short-lived radionuclides that can create ionization from the inside out. And then, so this I kind of put in the middle because it's sort of an internal and an external factor. It comes from the outside, but it ionizes from inside the disk, from its own bulk material. And then you can also have the star itself, due to the accretion process, X-rays that are either coming from the base of an accretion shock or are from gas, hot gas trapped in coronal loops, 10 million Kelvin or even 30 million Kelvin gas that can irradiate the local environment. You can also get UV from the accretion process as well. And if you have some sort of jet or wind, the shocks of these different processes can accelerate particles locally and create local energetic cosmic rays with slightly lower energies than what you get from the galactic cosmic rays. Now, these sort of processes, they occur over many different scales. So the star irradiates mostly the upper layers of the disk, so you have a UV skin followed by a deeper X-ray layer. External stars, these massive stars that might be nearby, can irradiate the outermost disk, where the radiation can penetrate. The same material can be bombarded by cosmic rays, so these are sort of an isotropic background, so they can ionize the outer disk and parts of the disk that are shielded from the star by the dense inner disk. And then, of course, these disks are dusty, and that dust may contain this radioactive 26 aluminum, and so that can ionize the disk from inside. So you get this really complicated picture of all these different ionization properties that affect how well the magnetic fields can couple to the disk itself. But we can sort of simplify and ignore some of the details and say, well, you have these different regions, and they're different dominated processes. But you might notice that the midplane is really dominated mostly by these cosmic rays and this radioactivity, and in the inner disk, also thermal ionization. Now we have evidence. We can measure the stellar UV field. We can measure the stellar X-ray field as well. We can also, you know, say from our own solar system, we have some amount of 26 magnesium that points to an excess of 26 aluminum that we had. So we were a little bit radioactive at the start. Of course, what's typical is still uncertain. I suggest you look at Juran Yang for maybe average values. But the cosmic ray rate has been largely unconstrained in disks. And you might also notice that sort of the two biggest uncertainties, the ones we can't directly measure in other systems, are the ones that dominate the midplane, what we call the planet-forming region. Now, historically, there have only been so far a few studies of disk ionization, and that's just because it's hard. Most of these studies have focused on this particular elusive ion, the H2D plus ion, that was first reported detected, I'll back up a little here, by Ciccarelli, 2004, in two sources, TW Hydra and DM Tau. And they took a simple analysis and said, if you balance the rate of ionization with the rate of recombination, what ionization rate do you require to reproduce the observed abundance? And they essentially got out, okay, TW Hydra is ionized at 10 to the minus 17 ionizations per second, which is sort of like the galactic cosmic ray background. That's okay. DM Tau is a little low. It's like 10 to the minus 18 ionizations per second. A few years later, Guillotot 2006 came around and said, wait a second, that line is not in the right place. That is not where DM Tau, its local velocity rests. And so they say this should probably be considered like a 2 sigma upper limit, generously. But that, you know, gets interesting, right? So DM Tau was the low one. It had the low cosmic ray ionization rate. So what does that mean if this is now an upper limit as well? A few years later, Karin Oberg had a study on the same disk, actually, DM Tau, and they observed H2D plus deeper and didn't see anything. So no surprise, this was not real. They collected a bunch of other molecular ion lines and started to put together this picture that all these different molecular ions are tracing different layers, like Meredith pointed out in her talk earlier. So you have different layers, different tracers of different regions and ways to measure their ionization structure, and she was able to pull out a gradient that went increasing to decreasing as you get close to the midplane. And fast forward again to 2017, we still haven't detected H2D+. There have been deeper observations, and there's a very, very nice upper limit that we're working on now towards TW Hydra, so this other tentative detection. So this one is also out. So where are cosmic rays? This caused us to want to investigate what's going on with cosmic rays a little further. And we started off on this pathway by being motivated by our own sun. So the sun has its own very strong ability to modulate the cosmic ray flux within 120 AU region. This is the solar heliosphere. And so this is just a balance of the solar wind pressure against the local ISM. So we thought, well, why can't young stars have their own little heliosphere? And that is HL Tau. So I'm not buying you guys rounds of drinks, but it's there. And so, you know, the solar wind can remove more than 99% of cosmic rays, especially those below 100 MeV. And so here's the cosmic ray spectrum for the interstellar medium. Notice this very wide range towards low energies. This is why it's notoriously hard to measure. Here is the cosmic ray flux at 1 AU in the solar system. And so the sun's doing a pretty good job at removing those cosmic rays, especially below 100 MeV. So we explored these solar models and we said, what if you turn up all the knobs? These young stars have high surface magnetic activity, they have higher mass loss rates, they're also spinning pretty rapidly, and that's actually the main reason the sun is so good at removing cosmic rays, is this azimuthal wind component. So we turned up these models and essentially got a couple more orders of magnitude reduction, but that was sort of a simple toy model. And more recently, Jeremy Drake has run calculations with actually a full heliosphere model, but putting a tetari in it. And he found that the cosmic ray flux with distance from the star is substantially reduced as you get closer to the star for out to many hundreds of AU. And so these are just different energy curves. All of these are pretty high energy cosmic rays. And you get orders of magnitude reduction in the cosmic ray flux relative to what he normalized as the heliosphere or tetariosphere edge. And so if I put those points from his more detailed models, they actually fit nicely on our curve by chance, I would say. But, you know, maybe we got it right. So if you take these curves and you convert them into a cosmic ray ionization rate, you have to assume some kind of cross-section for the ionization of H2, you get the cosmic ray ionization rate as a function of depth into, in this case, a slab. And here's the 100 grams per centimeter squared that many people use in their models for the threshold for cosmic ray ionization. And so the ISM is sitting up here. That's where the, you know, our best determination of the external, the ISM cosmic ray rate is from the Voyager mission up here. And so, yes, the sun reduces about 2 orders of magnitude in cosmic ray ionization for solar-type wind, and a T-Tauri model can do another 2 orders of magnitude. And these orders of magnitude got us a little worried because it dropped below the ionization rate for radioactivity. So we have to actually start thinking about radioactivity now when we think about ionization in disks. And so if you actually look at the distribution of, if you assume something about the distribution of radioactivity in disk, if you assume an abundance of 26 aluminum like our own solar systems, one of the key things that previous models had not included was the fact that these particles, these positrons, these gamma rays, they have stopping, they require stopping column densities of something like a gram per centimeter squared. It's hard to hold on to those. And so if you take that into account, you find out that the cosmic ray ionization, radionuclide ionization rate should decrease with distance because you're losing a lot of that energy to the to space, actually. And so we calculated that in detail. We found that it would reduce the radionuclide, so short-lived radionuclide ionization rate by about an order of magnitude, going from the inner disk where you have high surface density of material to the outer disk. But then, of course, the whole curve decreases with time. So we provided fits to this. So that you can include them in your models more easily. So it fits with surface density and with time. So what's left? We're killing cosmic rays, we're killing radionuclides. So you have X-rays. So the star is a bright X-ray source. We know there are these the components due to the X-ray corona as well as accretion. We can measure different cosmic or X-ray profiles. And then we can calculate how these X-rays interact with a given disk model, including both the absorption and the scattering. So this is using a Monte Carlo code developed by Tom Bethel at the University of Michigan. And so we can include in these codes settling, we can include all these things you've been hearing about all morning, and calculate how the X-rays interact with the disk. And if you put these all into the same sort of plot together, you find out that the different ionization contributions to the midplane are all over the place. You have cosmic rays, so an unshielded rate up here at 10 to the minus 17, as far down as 10 to the minus 20. You can have these X-rays interact with the disk differently depending on the hardness of the X-ray spectral slope. If you have a very hard X-ray spectrum, the X-rays just go through the disk, so it's kind of like a distance squared dependence. And then these are softer X-ray spectra. And then the radionuclides provide the sort of base to the ionization, excuse me. So how do we actually go about constraining any of this? We have this huge, almost, here we go, 7 orders of magnitude in variation, and these are all plausible models. So fortunately, we have this picture, and for the one time, the universe has been kind to us by giving us a sort of simple-ish chemical structure, where you have CO in the upper layers where the disk is warmish, above 20 Kelvin, and the HCO plus ion is abundant. So this can trace your X-ray layers. You can go deeper in the disk when the CO starts to freeze out, N2H plus peaks up, and so that gives you more constraints on a combination of X-rays and cosmic rays. And then deep in the disk, this H2D plus ion can give us constraints on the cosmic ray flux. So we model this, how much time? Okay, good, all right. We can get the fun stuff. So we model the chemical structure of disks in disks using sort of a general, this was a in this exploration, a general minimum mass solar nebula-like disk that we shot photons at. Then using the physical conditions, we can calculate how the chemical abundances evolve with time. We can simulate observations, both in LTE and non-LTE, with and without turbulence. And we then can compare to observations where we have them. So if we take a grid like this, where we have these different molecular ions on the different rows, and these different columns are just different assumptions of the cosmic ray rate, excuse me. If you just zoom in here, the regions that are purple are highly abundant in these ions, and then the regions that are green are low abundance. And so just going from a high cosmic ray rate to a sort of low cosmic ray rate, you can drop by 4 orders of magnitude in your abundance locally, excuse me, in these species. getting over a cold, so trying to fight a cough. So these are detectable effects. 4 orders of magnitude is a good thing. Factor of 2 is kind of wishy-washy, but 4 orders of magnitude I can work with. So we applied these results to our nearest and best studied friend, TW Hydra, frenemy. And it's 61 parsecs away, according to Gaia. And it moved again, and as a gas-rich disk. And so we have a lot of information on this disk. So we can actually constrain a lot of the properties. We can constrain its physical structure using a spectral energy distribution of the dust. We actually know how much gas it has from an HD observation of Herschel. We can constrain how much CO, or how much carbon there is in the gas phase, as Ted alluded to in the discussion earlier today. We can calibrate also how much nitrogen is in the gas phase using HCN observations. So we have a lot of information, and on this we can say, given some observations of N2H+, HCO+, what's the ionization structure of this disk? HCO+, again, gives us X-ray constraints, and N2H+ gives us X-rays and cosmic rays. We also have some spatially resolved observations, so this is sort of pre-ish ALMA. This is our SMA observation. This is an early ALMA observation of this disk. This is 3 days. These are different configurations. And this is like 30 minutes of ALMA time. So it's definitely hard to compete in some sense, but hard-won data. And a host of other lines, including multiple transitions, to get at this temperature effect Meredith alluded to. And so because we wanted to make sure that we had sort of the right X-ray spectrum and that we weren't biasing ourselves by locking in the X-ray spectrum, which has been well characterized, we know that the X-rays are variable from the source. So we played with different hardness ratios of our X-ray spectrum. These the X-ray luminosities here are only a factor of 3 different, so they're almost pretty similar in fluxes. And then we tried these different cosmic ray models. And so the next plot is complicated, so here's a zoom-in of how we characterized our best fit models. So you'll see a bunch of pie charts. I know you probably haven't seen pie charts since 5th grade, but I use them, and Aptria is okay with that. So these are different lines that we were fitting, and bigger pi slices mean better fits within 1 sigma, small slice means fits within 3 sigma, and no pi is bad always, right? No, you always want pi. So if I zoom this out, to help guide your eye, the best fit models that had the most pi are these ones down here, and the yellow slices, or the yellow pies are the best fit models. You might notice that all of these models have sub-ISM cosmic ray rates, and our 2 best fit models were a factor of 100 and a factor of, or more low, compared to the galactic cosmic ray rate. So what's going on? Well, you could have, like we suggested, maybe the young star is powering winds that are shielding the disk. You could also have maybe a photoevaporative wind that might envelop the entire disk, sort of like these large bow shock structures we see in Orion. And the propellids. They could also have magnetic fields within the disk. If they're very tangled, they could provide a source of local opacity to cosmic rays that are impinging on it. And it's an interesting number because it's kind of close to the radionuclide ionization rate, but it's a pretty old disk, so we'd be surprised if it still had a significant amount of radioactivity by now. It should have probably decayed away. So interesting consequences. Well, I thought Neil would talk about dead zones, and he didn't. Well, you had a slide. But so I put this in there a moment ago, and it's terrible resolution because I grabbed it from Google Images. But this is a slide we'll probably see again at some point. Maybe? I don't see any nodding. I'm glad I showed it. Although it does drive me a little crazy. The dimensions here, the star is huge compared to this disk. It's shining down like from above, like God from above. I don't, this.
Star wouldn't be very interesting.
We see where Lee's coming from. So this is a stellar radius, or 10 stellar radius for the X-ray loops. Well, at 1 AU, the disk should be 50 times bigger, so even close to the star. So whatever. Well, so I'll get to my plot. Well, here, I'll show this. This is illustrating you can have parts of the disk that are sufficiently ionized that they can couple to the magnetic fields and be unstable to the magneto-rotational instability, which is part of why we're here. Parts of the disk that aren't good at this are the dead zones. You can also have undead zones that are excited by the nearby alive parts, I guess. And so what sets the size of this dead zone? You can have X-rays will limit the uppermost layers, Well, cosmic rays can limit the outermost extent, so if you had a higher X-ray rate, you can flatten out your dead zone. If you have a higher X-ray rate, it flattens, higher cosmic ray rate, truncates. And so we put in our different cosmic ray models and explored what the size of the dead zone could be. And so if you have a very high cosmic ray rate, like this is close to diffuse ISM level cosmic ray rate, most of your disk is active except, you know, a very flat region in the midplane out to 20 AU. If you turn it down to the solar wind at maximum, your cosmic ray rate expands to 40 AU. And then if you have a very low cosmic ray rate and no additional radioactivity, you're relying on just UV from the star to ionize the surface. So you have only an active surface and a dead midplane all the way up to 400 AU. And so applying these same calculations to TW Hydra, which we derived the low cosmic ray rate for, we found that the dead zone extended based on the chemical models and the electron fractions derived there. The dead zone extended to about 50 AU, 50 or 60 AU, which is kind of an interesting scale because this is the same scale in which we've seen this dust be compacted into. So maybe this is a dead zone that's a low turbulence region that dust is growing in. Speculative. So here's the fun stuff. I saved time for this. Ongoing work. So you heard about this ALMA thing. It's been kind of changing our lives every single time we get new data. I love this image because in the background you have the Orion's Belt sitting right here. And so this is a fantastic facility, fantastic viewing conditions when it's not raining and flowers blooming. Who knows what's happening. But it's at a great site and has 60 antennas spread out over 16 kilometers, so you have very high resolution observations. And we got lots of beautiful data on a particular disk. I am loopy. Not are you loopy, but I am loopy. Thanks, Lee. And this is cycle 2 data of two of our observations of 12 CO and 13 CO 2-1. Here's the beam down here. And the goal of these observations were to map out ionization with spatial resolution across the face of this disk. We coupled the observations with SWIFT, so sort of during the same year as the ALMA observations were taken, to make sure the star wasn't doing anything particularly crazy. So we got a lot of gorgeous data, and there were additional gorgeous data sets on the archive. And so just taking all the CO data that existed, these are CO, different CO isotope logs, different transitions, 2-1, 3-2. Here's the dust, looks a lot different from the gas. You might notice this little hole in the middle. We think that's not real. We think it's dust opacity blocking our view of the central 20-ish AU, which is kind of sad from learning about terrestrial planet forming regions, but so it goes. But fitting all this ALMA data, we were able to actually put constraints on the amount of external radiation impinging on this disk. So these are just different chemical models of CO for different external radiation field levels. So G0 of 1 and 1 Hobbing is one average Milky Way galactic UV field. And then 16 is just turned up by a factor of 16. And so you end up with both a warmer outer disk if you have a high G0 and more truncated CO. So this is a case when you have a non-monotonic temperature profile where it's not a sharp transition, but it goes from warm near the star to cool to warm again. So that's another thing to add to these, to our parameterized models. What's cool about this as well is that our best fit models had a G0 of 4 or less, or 2-4 was our best fit to the amount of external radiation incident on the CO disk, which was entirely consistent with the known stellar population from Barcos. So this is a close by star. It's 161 parsecs away, so we know what all the O and B stars are in the vicinity. So we can calculate how each one irradiates the disk. The biggest uncertainty is the fact that we don't know line of sight extinctions. We do know them for the northern hemisphere, but they haven't. Doug Finkbeiner's group is working on 3D dust maps of the entire galaxy, and they just haven't gotten around to this part. So using a range of possible extinction per parsec-ish values, we can get G0s of 2-4 being the ideal rate, amount of external radiation from the Parcos. But the point of this was ionization. So we have all these other lines that we're fitting as well. So as I started working on fitting all these different lines, we found something completely surprising. The H13CO plus line varied by a lot, by a factor of 2. The change in the integrated line flux is 26 sigma. And so the beauty of this is that we have continuum and we have the line observations. And so we can see that the continuum here stayed put. It did not change one bit. And then the line on the first two epochs basically stayed put. And then on the third epoch, doubled. You can see it in the spectrum. And you can even see it in the visibilities, which is amazingly how bright this line is. So I mentioned that we had the SWIFT data. So we were like, well, maybe. Now, what's the star doing in X-rays? And no surprise, it also varied. So here are the X-ray points over time. This is, you know, roughly a year of data. First two observations of the H13CO plus line were basically consistent, and then it expanded in the last one. So our idea is that perhaps, you know, during this gap of observations, which unfortunately, oh, bad choice of words. The reason we didn't have SWIFT observations at this point is that I was getting married. And so I wasn't paying attention to the fact that SWIFT wasn't taking my data. Don't blame me. So we don't know what the star was doing at that point. But we know that it has varied in the past. And so our ideas, with my gratuitous use of Keynote, a flare, which then irradiates the disk, and then over time will recombine and fade. So oops. So if we go back and we look at this thing again, it should have dropped back down to its steady state HGO plus value. And we expect the HGO plus to be much more sensitive to this because it's closer, and it's in the X-ray irradiated surface. So we put chemical models behind this where we ran the chemical model for 500,000 years. The challenge is that you need half an hour resolution in your chemical models, but you need to do it for a million years. That's a lot of data. That's a lot of points. So you can't do that. So you have to sort of fast forward your simulation for a certain amount of time and then turn on X-ray flares. And so we found that a flare of a factor of 10, but sustained over about a day, would be able to reproduce the H13CO+, or a very high 35 factor, very impulsive flare over a short time works, too. The chance of seeing this one would be about 16% based on typical Titari-like flaring behavior, and I think this was about 3%. So we were very lucky, but not that lucky. And how many minutes? Okay, so, all right, so moving on to, so the goal of this again was to derive the ionization structure of ion loop, and we're trying to get there. And we're finally starting working on these models. So this is unpublished. We're still working on these, and I ran these last night and on the plane over here. So there are these beautiful observations of DCO plus that were reported originally in Oberg 2015 towards ion loop. And you notice it has this very interesting double ring structure. This is not a slab. This has got a lot of structure to it. And so our initial models, where we're running simulations with a high cosmic ray flux, like an interstellar cosmic ray flux, and reducing our cosmic ray flux by a factor of 100, we seem to be able to actually pick out two rings only with a low cosmic ray flux. And this is because adding a lot of cosmic rays to the disk ionizes basically the entire slab of CO. So you end up with a sort of smooth distribution, whereas a low cosmic ray flux lets you peek out interesting features in the midplane, which are shown here. So one additional interesting feature of ion loop, which also wildly speculative, is that this is a pretty young disk. It's not that far from SCOSEN, and there have been a lot of recent supernovae in that region. And so we noticed that if we change the amount of radioactivity in the disk, so this is a model in which we actually took into account the fact that the dust and gas are completely separate in their distributions. And the dust is a little bit flatter in its distribution than the gas. And we think that's possibly due to the dust being stopped at larger radii in these trapped in these ring-like features like we have in HL tau. Also, no drinks here either. And so this dust is the source of radioactive ionization. The gas provides an extinction source. And so you can calculate at each point how much radioactivity should affect your ionization rate. And what you get is this red ionizing donut of flux at the outer edge. This is opposite from the original models, which had the dust following the gas. And this is just because you have more dust trapped at these larger radii. And so if you have no radioactivity in your models, and these are all low cosmic ray models, you end up with a DCO plus slab. This is the X-ray irradiated region, and not much going on in here. But if you turn up the radioactivity, you can get a second ring readily in the outer disk. And those were the models I showed in the previous slide. And that's it for here. Yeah. So with that, on my conclusions. So ionization is important. It affects also how well the disk can couple to magnetic fields. We have modeled in detail the X-ray rate, the cosmic ray rate, the radionuclide rate, and all of these are important for setting the molecular ionization structure on the disk, but in different locations and at different times. We modeled TW hydride, found that the cosmic ray rate was very low, and preliminary modeling of ion loops suggests that the cosmic ray rate is also low there, but it may have a time variable, X-ray driven chemistry, and perhaps radioactivity as well. So with that, I'll take questions. Thank you.
Thank you.
So clearly, the number of free electrons you have determines how well you can couple to magnetic fields. Is the saturation level of the MRI dependent on the free electron density? Can that get parameterized?
I feel like this is a great question for Juning here, who is so I used his parameterizations for what sets active versus dead. So what critical electron fraction density you need, but.
Yeah, I guess the story is more complicated than that because depending on where you are in the disk, and also it's not only just electron ionization fraction, but also the absolute density in the system. And so there are three non-ideal MHC effects, and people, when talking about dead zone, people normally only consider ohmic resistivity, and that it's mainly the ionization fraction that sets the criteria. But for other effects, it's a combination of magnetic field strengths, and there are other factors that come into it. So it's more complicated.
Yeah, these were, if I have it correctly, these were all assuming like a weak magnetic field that gas pressure is
dominated. For the ohmic resistivity, yeah, this magnetic Reynolds number criteria, well, that number, well, in practice, the better number is the Alsace number, which is field strength dependent.
Right.
Well, typically people quote Alsace number 1, okay, or translating to magnetic Reynolds number, say 1,000 to 10,000, if you are assuming a reasonable plasma beta. But you also mentioned that AM. I wonder whether you have done anything serious about that number.
These are all just using the simple electron fraction and local gas density that comes out of the models.
Regarding that ion loop disk, I also wonder if you have done similar kind of thing given your best fit model, especially because this disk is a huge disk, but it's not quite accreting, and it's very interesting to.
Oh yeah, I didn't mention that the disk mass is something like 0.17, or roughly 0.2 solar masses of gas. The accretion rate is extremely low. It has upper limits.
Yeah.
It's just sitting there, and it's like 0.5 million years old.
Yeah, exactly. I think you can look at those numbers next and to see whether there's any clues.
Yeah, I'm still trying to fit all the lines first, but yeah.
So this time dependence is a very exciting development. Could you give us a sense of what I guess the big question is, what are the prospects for backing out the density and maybe the dust content in the regions where we see these ions?
So
how degenerate are those two things? I mean, I don't have a good sense for how quickly HCO plus recombines.
Yeah, so the recombination timescale is entirely set by recombination with electrons. And in the layers
free electrons.
With free electrons. And those electrons are not coming actually from the X-ray ionization of the molecular gas. They're coming largely from the ionization of carbon. So it's all C plus. This is in a layer where you also have UV photons. So if you can measure the decay timescale, if you can get ALMA to let you monitor for 2 weeks and fit that, you can measure the electron fraction, you have to know the gas density. You can make assumptions, but it's less certain. But you can directly measure the electron space density by measuring that e-folding timescale of HCO plus.
Yeah, so also on the, could you put the SWIFT and light curve up again?
Which was it?
Just the one that for IM loop, the time variability.
This one?
I think it was the next one. Yes, this.
Got it.
So the thing I was surprised by is, so I think you're saying that there's a sort of an unseen flare in there somewhere around, whatever, 250 days or whatever.
Yeah.
Is it not surprising, if that's the reason for this increase in the line strength, that the two previous measurements are like spot on, despite the fact that you apparently have variability by factors of 2 to 5 all over the place?
Yeah, so that's a really good point. So here, this one is before the variability, in the X-ray flux. So unfortunately here, you know, unless it was active before, that's not really as much of a problem. Here, this is only a factor of 2, and a factor of 2 change in X-ray flux. So we ran simulations of constant teeny flares, like factor of 2 flares, every day, and it changed, I keep getting blinded, the HCO plus abundance by 10%. So we wouldn't have been able to see that change. But it does mean that the HCO plus flux is always staying at a 10% high state. So it goes up by 10% and never, as long as that factor of 2 variability is happening, it never settles back down. It just stays at that level. It's a tiny level, but it's interesting.
Next, but maybe let me take Chair's prerogative to ask a question. You, much of your talk was focused on limiting fluxes, cosmic ray flux, ionization flux, mm-hmm. but can't you not really limit XC, you know, the ionization fraction for, that's really what you can limit?
Yeah, so that's a really good point.
That's the most important thing to limit in the dynamical models. I mean, we don't really care what the sources of ionization are at some level. What we care is actually knowing what the ionization fraction is, so then we, otherwise it's dependent on dust and settling and growth, and it could be quite complicated to...
It's still dependent on all those things,
right.
But
XC is not, right? I mean, that is just what you've measured. And
so XC can be affected by dust growth, by the grains becoming charged too. So yes. Dust can get involved there too.
Right.
So XC is a natural parameter that comes out of the models. And I also should have been clear, when we limited the cosmic ray rate on TW Hydra, we limited it from, that's really the ionization rate limit from all sources too. So that's radionuclides, cosmic rays, X-rays in the midplane. That is an upper limit to all ionization sources. Cosmic rays were just the most interesting of those. But yeah, so XC comes out of all of this.
It's sort of more the more fundamental thing you're measuring. Is that correct or is that incorrect?
Sure.
So I just wanted to mention that. Did you look at the duty cycle of X-rays for young stars, because much of the X-ray luminosity actually does come out in flares at this early age?
Yeah, so my percentages of catching the flare are completely based on the Chandra Orion Ultra Deep Survey. So they stared at Orion for 13 days and got statistics on, I think it was something of order 30 young stars that showed flaring behavior. Many more stars in Orion, but of the 30 stars that showed flaring behavior, they had distributions of the frequencies of flares. And so that's assuming those distributions, the commonality of a factor of 35 flare, as seen in our 3 observations, was that 3%. So yeah, that's where it comes from.
I guess my more to the point was how many small flares would you have, which would give you that. Right. I mean, so, okay, you can have a big thing and that's a small frequency event and whatever, right? But what about the average?
So the factor of 10x flare was my small event, even though that is not in, you know, a typical flare is this 2x flare. So you can either have smaller flares at the factor of it has to be at least square of the magnitude of what you need in HCO plus, so it'd have to be at least a factor of 4x flare, and if they're 4x flares, they have to be lined up back to back so that the chemistry can never start recombining with the electrons and decay back. So the factor of 10x flare was the proxy for a smaller event needed, but it still has to be a pretty big event.
I was wondering if there was some way of directly measuring the electron density, like from a plasma frequency or from it affecting something going through the disk. I don't have any particular idea right now, but it seems to me that if you could do that, then you'd get the answer to Jim's question.
I think measuring that recombination time is your best bet. I think that's pretty much it.
What is the solid angle of the X-ray source? I mean, when we have a flare, and if it's very close to the stellar surface, half of the disk can be obscured by the
star. Yeah.
By the star.
Yeah, that's a great, that's an excellent question, and I kind of snuck around it by putting my flare as a beacon coming from the top of the star, because you may have noticed that the H13 CFLS increased on both sides of the disk. This disk extends out to like 600 AU. So this has to be really, it either has to be a prolonged 10x event that lasts long enough for the star to rotate, and it's an 8-day rotation period, or it has to be an impulsive flare from above, or a 10x flare from above. It has to be either a beacon coming from above, or last long enough to irradiate the entire disk. I favor the beacon. Seems a little bit less, maybe more probable.
So can these powerful flares have any influence on the dead zone, or is there a combination time scale just too short?
I think it would have an effect during the flare, but then it would in a 2-week period. And so maybe you would get a corresponding enhancement onto the accretion rate in the star, and we could observe H alpha at the same time. But yeah. I don't know.
Presumably, you have to raise the ionization state for at least an orbital time scale, or a couple of orbits to actually get MRI to go. So.
I can't hear you.
I say presumably you'd have to actually be able to raise ionization state for a couple of orbits.
To have a major effect on, global mass budget. Yeah, this is not going to be, I don't think, maybe. If you have enough of them, they might, but.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah, actually a related question. So if we follow Chris's argument further, the rise in, the transient rise in ionization maybe increases alpha or turbulent transport. Can we sort of predict that after such and such time we'll see something, on the accretion side, can that affect the, can that give us an estimate of alpha in this transient state?
It's
too short?
This is only operating for about 2 weeks. So I don't know how that would compare if you changed alpha for 2 weeks, what the delta T would be for mass pile up onto the star. Yeah.
I see.
Okay, so you got to be really patient.
So there'll be no.
Could you comment on light travel times compared with chemical times and how long you can get the telescopes?
So it would be the light travel time. This is a mini 100 AU disk, so you have like 10 hours for the flare to sort of spread out over the disk, or maybe up to 20 hours to the outer edges. And so you'll have, you need to be monitoring the star to actually see the initial X-ray flare. You're not gonna, you're pretty unlikely to catch a 10x event by random chance. But the chemical signature lasts for about 2 weeks. So you have plenty of time to go put in your director's discretionary time for ALMA, which I would love to do. But we need the smoking gun of the X-ray going off first, so.
Could we potentially do reverberation mapping?
Electron reverberation mapping. You could get the electron fraction as a function of position from the star. You just have to measure the decay rate of the HGO plus signature as a function of distance from the star. Yeah, completely. We just have to convince ALMA to let us do time domain.
It's not a very time-responsive instrument. I mean, the DDT took about a month.
Exactly. Maybe in cycle 5.
Any more questions?
Just a comment on the location of your X-ray source. Okay, if you have some sort of a disk wind, there will be a natural recollimation point.
Yeah.
And this could be a source of X-rays. But this is theoretical, but it has been observed in some T Tauri stars, X-ray jets that remains, X-ray knots that remains at the same position. So I would wonder whether you would have tried to put your X-ray source not so close to the star, but a bit upper. And that would be interesting to know what happens to that.
Is that, I think it's
About 20 AU over the disk.
Yeah, it's this like the clumps in the jet-like feature. I think it's DG tau, maybe.
No, it's not. In the X-ray source, it's not. I will look for
okay,
it for
sure.
you. But it's about 20 AUs over the disk.
Yeah.
So you will have a preferred illumination, mm-hmm. and it would be interesting to see what happens to your model changing that. Okay.
It would enhance the X-ray rate throughout the disk, certainly.
Thank you.
Nice talk.